Good evening, Met fans and baseball fans alike. Welcome to a Metsian podcast special in search of the elusive general manager. Without hesitation, let me bring on my co-hosts. First, I'll start with the proprietor of this whole operation, Sam. How you doing, buddy?
Well, I am on location today in Jersey City, but by the end of it, I'll have the world on a string on Sinatra Drive in Hoboken.
You know, it's funny. We had this conversation before. I named you the proprietor, Rich. You're actually bankrolling this whole thing, and we need to straighten that out. Say hello, Rich.
Well, thanks for that, Mike. So, hello, everybody. And I like calling Sam the proprietor. I've usually referred to him as the brains behind the operation and the founder and all that, but I like proprietor. That sounds so official.
Well,
we
are here to talk Mets baseball, and again, this search for the elusive general manager. We have so many opinions on this that, you know, we've shared over the podcast. So I figured let's start just by setting the record straight before we move on. Very quickly, we know May and the month of June just torpedoed the Mets season. We have opinions as to what needs to happen moving forward in order to correct that. That being said, Sandy Alderson stepped down due to health reasons. And here's the question. In hindsight, did Jeff Wilpon throw Sandy Alderson under the bus? Sam?
Well, you know, I keep hearing, and I know that it's the cliche thing to do and the trendy thing to do to hit on the Wilpons, and rightly so. They have plenty of criticisms to be passed around. However, I don't think that a lot of people like to group the idea that he threw them under the bus. You know, Sandy's this, you know, he's an elder GM who had to leave because of health reasons. Now, you know, just like in other facets, I don't think that, you know, other facets of life, I don't think that exempts you from criticism. I wish him nothing but the best of health, as I've always said. But I don't think that, you know, Jeff needs to – I don't think the idea is that Jeff deflected criticism by criticizing Sandy. I think that Sandy had some great, great moments over the course of 7 years. We went to a World Series because of it. But I don't think that exempts him from the criticism that the game passed him by and caught up to him. And I think that, rightly so, Jeff pointed some of these issues out. I don't have exactly the things that he said, but I don't think that Jeff was out of his element to be criticizing Sandy Alderson when talking about what he's going to be looking for in the offseason from a GM.
You know what? You're not wrong. But at the same time, I'm just playing devil's advocate here for a second. The Mets have a long history of saying not so nice things about people once they're out the door. Now, Rich, you know I like to layer things upon each other. So, you know, you answer the question, did Jeff Wilpon throw Sandy Alderson under the bus? But at the same time, your opinion on his desire to keep this three-headed monster intact, and the fact that John Rico was part of the first wave of interviews along with Jeff.
Well, you know, I find it hard to disagree with what Sam just said about Sandy Alderson and did Jeff throw him under the bus. I mean, the fact of the matter is it's a business of accountability. And if you look at facts, yes, Sandy Alderson, the Cespedes trade that was kind of, you know, happened serendipitously, but the Cespedes trade was a great moment. Bringing Syndergaard in was a great moment. Getting a team to the World Series was certainly an achievement. But his portfolio is very mixed. You know, he left the team with a very poor farm system, you know, one of the worst in baseball, I believe 27th out of 30. And that has to fall on his shoulders. Some of the contracts he signed certainly were not the best. So for him, I don't think his resume of work is entirely positive. Now, when he leaves the organization, you know, Jeff had some things to say. Well, you know what? That's kind of what you sign up for when you become a general manager of a baseball team, especially one in New York. I mean, look what Steinbrenner said about his folks on their way out the door. So it is a results business, and you are accountable. And maybe it's not nice but sometimes the world isn't nice. You know, sometimes you're accountable and people say you screwed this up or you screwed that up. So I really don't have a problem with what Jeff Wilpon said about Sandy. And then moving to your other question about Rico and the three-headed monster and all of that. Now, here's where I can criticize Jeff Wilpon and the Wilpons in general, because having Rico, think about this. Well, John, you know, you've been a part of this organization for a long time, and as assistant general manager, you're not really a candidate for the job going forward, which is a job you've clearly been angling for. But would you mind being a part of the interview team so we can hire the person who is going to be the GM? It just sounds weird, and you wonder what Rico's head, you know, where his head was when he was doing this. It's just a very bizarre thing. And the idea of keeping the three-headed monster is the other side of the Wilpon coin, because that just shows you that they're exerting a lot of influence. Why not let the new GM determine if these guys have a role? You know, why does Jeff have to say, before I even come in the door, these are my three boys, you know, my three boys are going to stay? It just shows the meddling that we all hope would stop.
I'm glad you took it in that direction, because that is exactly why I wanted to set the condition. Because we have two individuals who just rejected the Mets outright. Thad Levine with the Twins organization, and Ben Sherrington. And to me, that's a pretty big name to be rebuffing the Mets. You know, I don't remember who said it or who wrote it, but they were correct in saying that, you know, this job, a National League job in New York, should be one of the elite positions in all of baseball. And everyone should want this position, but for some reason you have people just running away from it like the plague. And Ben Sherrington was one of them. Thad Levine, perhaps people aren't as familiar with, but Sherrington is definitely one of those executives who are, you know, well-known throughout baseball. So the fact that these two individuals, and I'm sure there's another one that escapes me, but they just rejected the Mets outright. So, Rich, pick it up from there.
Well, I think that's a perfect segue, Mike, from where we just were, which is they don't want to work for the Wilpons. It's that simple. And what else can it be? Because you hit the nail on the head. You know, New York National League Baseball it's prestigious, especially when you could be the person who brings this team, you know, back to prominence. So the cachet value of the role and the glitz around the role is something that aspiring GMs or GMs in other smaller towns should be, you know, chomping at the bit to get. So then you ask yourself, well, why are these people walking away in droves? And the reason is pretty clear. You know, they don't want to come into this situation with this meddling ownership and with what is probably still a bit of a small market mentality. So, you know, while earlier, like I said, I don't hold the Wilpons accountable for some stuff, but here's one where how can you not hold them accountable? People are walking away from a glitzy job in the biggest city, a baseball crazed market, because they don't want to work for these owners. There is no other rational explanation, and that's clearly what it is. So here's a situation where the ownership is really hurting the team, because, you know, you'd love to have a Sherrington as your GM or vice president of baseball operations, and it's just not happening because it's not the work environment these people want.
Sam, just to be fair, Sherrington also turned down the San Francisco Giants, and Ken Rosenthal in a tweet said that Sherrington wants to build from the ground up. Why wouldn't he want to do that in New York? But the same question applies to you. The fact that these guys are just rejecting the Mets outright.
Yeah, I mean, the Wilpons have a reputation. I think, like we've been trying to give Jeff specifically right now credit for, he might be trying to change some of that reputation, but you can't shake it off that easily. It takes a little while to change behaviors and to change, and he might be adapting as comfortably as he can right now. And I like the direction he's going, you know, and we'll get into it a little bit more thoroughly in a little bit regarding, you know, the candidate, Doug Melvin, who was dropped as one of the finalists. It should be a coveted job, and it's not. And the Wilpons have to do a lot of mirror looking, if you will. And they might be doing so. You know, it is how it is. You know, like I've always said with Sandy Alderson, he was brought in to correct a 50-year issue with Foundation where the cement never settled. And mind you, he did a great job in setting them up better to have some long-term success. It was still a little bit of a blip on the map, and now they have to correct some of the offsetting once he had to go all in 2015. I like the names that we'll get into, specifically just the fact that there's a Rays guy involved, and it's just every year you look up, and there they are again. And especially this year, it was remarkable, and they just, you know, talk about a three-headed monster in the AL East with the Rays at the bottom of it. But they have a lot to correct, but they may actually be on their way of doing so. Unfortunately, it wasn't soon enough for some of the big names in baseball to want the job.
Well, you mentioned him, Doug Melvin. Let's stick with him for a second, because the fact that he was a finalist, one of the final three, and fell out of the running today, that suggests to me that Jeff won a tug of war against his father. His father wanted a more traditional scouting-oriented type of individual, whereas Jeff wants to be a little bit more progressive. So the fact that Doug Melvin is out of the picture tells me that internally Jeff may have won a battle against his father. Rich, what say you?
Yeah, I think that kind of adds up. I think Melvin clearly, you know, it was like, which one of these is not like the others, right? Melvin stuck out as being, you know, older chronologically with older philosophies. And yes, we know that Fred wanted the, you know, traditional philosophy of, you know, going by your eyes and scouting and that kind of thing. And Melvin clearly represented that, and he's now out. And, well, at least we know we'll get into these guys later, but we know Bloom is heavily into the analytics side of it. And then Van Wegeren probably is somewhere in the middle. But anyway, it does seem to be that Jeff got his way and that the Mets are not going to go down the, you know, the old school approach, or at least not totally down that path. So, I think another part of it, I don't know what you guys might think of this, it might also be the public outcry about Melvin in the past few days was pretty significant. You know, people were pointing to the fact that when he left the Brewers job, you know, that people said that that they were saying, well, the guy was quoted as saying it's a younger man's game, and the game may have passed me by, and now he's 3 years older, and so does it make sense to did he get any younger in 3 years? I don't think he did. And so I think there was a lot of public outcry about that how can you do this? You know, a guy who self-admittedly said that the game may have passed him by and are going to put him in. So maybe there was some response to public pressure. I wonder what you guys think of that.
I agree with you 100%. In fact, I think, you know, Doug Melvin was in a situation where he was yearning to get back into the game, and he would have been agreeable to any preconditions the Wilpons would have set for him. And that's a situation that terrifies me. Sam.
Okay, let's go with that whole Moneyball thing, and I think it's actually a quote from the movie/book of one of the, you know, they're sitting around the scouting table and sitting around the draft board, and they're talking about an ugly girlfriend means no confidence, and you're just like, can we put this past us, please? You know, it's all these old school mentalities of this idea that you got to use your eyes. Yes, you definitely have to use your eyes. There's an element of that that you have to do. But, you know, at the same time, like I was saying with Sandy Alderson, you have to have an idea for what this new world of baseball needs, because otherwise it will pass you by. And if Doug Melvin is quoted as having said that, then I had no necessary confidence that he was going to be able to do the job that I am looking for. And it's a perfect example. When Sandy Alderson left, you saw a change in the fundamental way that the Mets played baseball. And instead of being station to station, and exactly what Sandy Alderson has wanted to do all the way back to being part of the A's, it completely changed into more of a, and you know, something that we as baseball fans sometimes crave, which is a little bit more spunk, a little bit more tenacity, a little bit more energy, which is also can fall into some old school ways, but it's just if you're talking about it being a young man's game, these are some of the best athletes. You know, nobody's ever been as in shape, and sometimes I think to a detriment when it comes to having too tight of muscles. But these guys are kind of like are world renowned athletes now, and they, why not let them, you know, run as fast as they can when they need to, when a ball is put in play. So I think that it's the right way, and I you hit the nail on the head too, Mike, about if they had brought Doug in, he would have just been like, all right, sure, guys, right, whatever you say, and I don't want that right now. Right. And that's what is so interesting about the Rays guy that I keep mentioning is just like he has figured a way, and maybe this is what they're thinking about too. From a small market perspective, to keep the Rays in contention year after year since 2008. And it's been impressive. And I'm not saying that obviously he's only a cog in that machine. But just like with Andrew Friedman in L.A., who has kept them in contention since he came aboard with the Magic Johnson crew, there seems to be something working within modern-day baseball and the world parity that exists right now in baseball.
All right, you guys are chomping at the bit. You're dying to say their names. It's Chaim Bloom from the Tampa Bay Rays. And I'm going to tap into my inner Bavaria, being that I spent a couple of years there. His name is Brody, and I'm going to pronounce that W with as is like a V, as far as my experience goes. So it's Brody Van Vagenen. Those are the two names. But before we get to them, let's talk about the guys and gals, for that matter, who didn't make it. First, let me start with an agent named Casey Close, an agent. Now, that's really out of the box, really out of the box. You could say what you will about that. Gary LaRocque is an old-school scouting guy, probably on Fred's list. But DeJohn Watson from Washington, he was a younger guy, but also with a scouting background. Perhaps these guys lost out in, you know, this inner battle between Jeff and Fred. We spoke of Doug Melvin. Then there was Dave Littlefield, who also interviewed in the first round, former Pittsburgh general manager. And, you know, I'm just terribly unimpressed by that. And then there's Kim, who worked for the Yankees, who worked for the Dodgers, who worked for MLB. And you know what? As far as I could see on Twitter, she had a lot of support. So any of those people, if you have anything to offer, Rich, you want to start?
Well, I thought Kim Ng has a great reputation. You know, she has a great reputation in baseball. When she was with the Dodgers, people had nothing but great things to say. Having worked with the Yankees as well and with MLB, it just seemed like she had the pedigree from those perpetually winning organizations. Now, again, we don't know if she didn't interview well. We don't know, you know, exactly what she may have not had that they were looking for. But I know when I saw that particular list, I was intrigued by Kim Ng for the reasons I mentioned. I was intrigued by Casey Close for the same reasons I'm intrigued by Van Vagenen, because he's an agent. And I think that is, just like you said, Mike, it's a different look at it. You know, you're taking somebody who's an agent who knows that side of the business. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean he will know how to run a baseball team from this side, but he knows that side of the business. He probably has a lot of really good contacts, probably could, you know, work out some deals for the organization. So it's an interesting way to look at it, you know, by maybe going on the agent side. So those were the two of the names you mentioned of the ones that did not make it. Those were the two that intrigued me the most. I agree with you on Littlefield. I just didn't see enough there to really think much of him. And LaRocque, to me, just seemed like, you know, a really old school baseball guy, you know, stuck in his ways, or just something unimpressive about him. But again, we don't know a lot about these people, but from what I've read, those are my thoughts.
Rich, I want you to continue. What insights do you think an agent, a very good agent, has into baseball organization?
The running of an organization, I think, would be that person's blind spot. I think where that person would have, you know, it's sort of like having the other team's playbook. You know, when you've negotiated contracts for players, and he's obviously negotiated some pretty big contracts for some pretty prestigious players, you know how that game is played. Like, in other words, you know what might be of value to that person, that maybe there's a way, you know, when they're talking to their clients, the client might say, look, you know, I'd really like to have 5 years, I'd like to have this much per year, but I'll sacrifice both of those for a limited no trade. And the agent obviously doesn't disclose all that when negotiating with the team, has that in the back pocket, and it just seems like he would know what that looks like and how that feels to have that negotiation from the other side. And I think that could be really valuable in bringing in free agents to the organization. But again, I do think his at least apparent blind spot would be building a team from the organization side, but still intriguing to me.
I don't even know why I bring this up, Sam, but would hiring Kim Ng in any shape, way, or form force the media to revisit that whole lawsuit against Jeff Wilpon and having them say that he's only trying to make up for that? It would have gone there, wouldn't it? It would have deteriorated to that, wouldn't it? Sam, you seem to be in a bad spot. Try to find a better signal. Rich, do you think that dynamic would have played out?
Yes, for sure. I think, you know, I no matter how sensitive we try to be to gender issues and all those things these days, the fact is if they hired a female, it would have been great, I think. But also the first thing the media would have jumped on is this is the Wilpons way to try to make that whole, you know, child out of wedlock thing go away. And you know, it's a cosmetic move, hiring a woman and all that. And yes, it would have definitely happened. It hopefully would have gone away after some time. When people realize, you know, that Kim Ng is qualified on her own merits and is not here to, you know, be a token for the Wilpons to smooth over a sexist-based thing. But it definitely would have gone there, for sure.
It's definitely a hypothetical, but, you know, as you say, Rich, she's qualified. She's more than qualified. I think that would have been a terribly intriguing dynamic going on there, and it would have been a downright shame had it gone down, you know, that street. I guess that's my biggest point. It would have been a shame. Thank goodness we're only dealing in a hypothetical, because it would have been a downright shame had it gone down that route. Sam, how's your signal now, buddy? Sam is still experiencing issues. All right, Rich, let's start focusing on these final two. Doug Melvin is officially out of the race. He didn't make the final cut. We caught wind of that today, or at least I caught wind of that today. Did you know of that prior to today?
I caught wind of it today. I caught wind that it was, as of last night, it was three people, and now it's two. So I caught wind of it today.
All right. So, you know, you've been in Deutschland, so you know Brody von Wagenen. And you elaborated on his potential insight as an agent into organizational issues. He has six clients on the Mets, one of them being DeGrom. Is that not a conflict of interest?
Not really. I think, you know, in organizations that happens all the time, you know, where you say to somebody, look, okay, you know, the minute you sign on to work for me, you're not that anymore. If you were a doctor in a previous life or whatever, you're not that. You now work for me and you're this. And so, and I think in this day and age, Mike, I think that's a non-issue. I really think so. I think he can just move past it and say, okay, you know, now he knows Jake, which is great. And that's what I was saying before, which is he probably knows what's really important to DeGrom and what DeGrom might respond to and not respond to, and I think that puts him in a good position to work with Jacob DeGrom. But I think he could. I think he would be professional enough to step away from the prior relationship and realize that he works for the Wilpons now and that his task is to work for the team.
Let's check in with Sam one more time. Sam, how's your signal now? Sam is still experiencing issues. Chaim Bloom from the Tampa Bay Rays, very well-rounded. Quite literally in all specs, in all aspects of running the organization. And he's young, which, you know, is good, you know, because when we were young, what was the saying? Never trust anybody over 30, right?
Right.
Baby boomers ruined the planet. So, you know, here we are. You know, the next generation is indeed taking over. Perhaps this guy, I like his background. I like his well-roundedness. I have more positive things to say about him than negative. I don't have many negative things to say about him other than I'm old and perhaps, you know, a little bit riddled with anxiety like perhaps Fred might be because I trust those old scouting types. I'll bring up analytics before I throw it back to you. All right, analytics. Here we are. We're in the era of analytics. And over the course of 162 games, you know what? That's fine. Because when you're dealing with the law of averages, you know, especially over 162 games, you're going to be proven right more often than not. But here we are in the playoffs, and we got one manager who's knocked off several teams, to include the defending World Series champions, who understands that analytics don't necessarily have a chance to play themselves out, or analytic-minded baseball doesn't necessarily have a chance to play itself out in a short series. But you have to manage small ball. You know, you have to approach that mentality, all hands on deck. And, of course, I'm talking about Alex Cora versus his opponents and his usage of the starting pitchers as relievers and circumventing what was supposed to have been a weakness. So, you know, analytics, I don't want the Mets to become, you know, we're going from an analytics department staffed by three people. I don't want to get addicted to the stuff now because I think the Yankees are overly addicted to analytics, and I think they've, you know, this year and last. Rich.
Yeah, you know, I think you hit it, Mike. It's going overboard on either one is probably not a good idea. You know, think about it, right? I'll hyperbole here, of course, but if the Mets brought in a bunch of 65-year-olds who had been scouts and, you know, had old-school philosophy and said, okay, this is now our group, probably not a good idea. Bringing in nothing but a bunch of 32-year-olds, you know, who are stuck in the Excel spreadsheets and don't really value old-fashioned scouting, probably not a good idea. So blending the two seems to make the most sense. I agree you don't want to go overboard on the analytics piece. And, you know, I think you're also right in the sense that there are no absolutes. Like, in other words, the analytics approach doesn't necessarily mean you're going to win every year. It doesn't mean it's going to play in the short series like you're talking about. Everything in life is in moderation, right? Baseball is the same way. You need to incorporate all kinds of different ways of building your team, ways of evaluating players, all of that. You know, and to go overboard on any one, I think that just sets you up for failure. I mean, if the entirely analytics approach was always the only one that would work, why isn't Theo Epstein one every year? He's sort of the poster child of that. Why hasn't he won each and every year? Why, you know, it doesn't make sense. The San Francisco Giants are pretty much built on the scouting philosophy, as we know, and they won the World Series in 10, 12, and 14. So you can win both ways.
Sam. Sam, you're there. Hey, buddy.
Yeah. Can you hear me?
My question, we hear you fine. We're finally talking about Brody Van Vagenen and Chaim Bloom.
How much did you hear of what I was saying about Kemp? Where did I leave off?
Yeah, you know what? You cracked up. You were coming in and out until you finally, you know, blicked out. So, you know, we'll revisit that. But I would, I just wanted to throw it at you this way, that Time Bloom is, I think, I read, if I read correctly, 34 years old. How does it feel to have somebody roughly your age running the Mets?
Well, I remember when it was like a big deal when Brian Cashman took over at age 32, and here we are now, back in 1998. So I think
revisit your point.
For one, it makes me realize that I am now the elder statesman if I were a baseball player, and it's like, oh, geez. And yet, if I were a GM, I'd be part of the young generation. And, you know, I keep going back with that Hayne Bloom. He seems to be part of a really consistent culture with the Tampa Bay Rays. And to the Wilpons, you know, I think one of the things the Wilpons might be thinking, able to work within a budget, because the Rays obviously do not go towards the moon when it comes to their money. And so I think that it's exactly what everybody around the Mets has really been craving after Sandy Alderson, like I keep saying, got the foundation of the franchise under control. I think that it's the correct way to go, even if analytics shouldn't hold completely firm, kind of like Rich was saying. It's Theo Epstein doesn't win the World Series every year, although he is a Hall of Famer now. I think that it's the right way, the right direction to go with the Mets franchise, especially if some of the higher coveted people are turning the job down. I'm not exactly sure what he's going to be thinking about when it comes to Mickey Callaway, but it might be a match made in heaven. I'm going to let you go ahead and pronounce the agent's name for me. Yoannis Cespedes' agent's name for me, Brody Von
Vaganen. Take the W and pronounce it like a V. Vaganen.
Well, it's the reason why I get shut down whenever I say Kevin Plawecki, because that's clearly the actual way of pronouncing it instead of Kevin Plawecki. It's like you take a hard stop at the red light there. You don't keep it flowing anyway. Mr. Brody. it is interesting. I think Rich really brought up most of the things that I could about the angle of the agent going into that. I mean, he might have to catch up similar, you know, you can't just expect a pitching coach to all of a sudden have success as a major league manager, especially in the National League, switching from the American League, and that's what we're seeing with Mickey Callaway. But at the same time, we also saw Mickey Callaway a little bit with how to do things by the end of it and play the game, you know, manage the game a little bit better. And so I think that's my last concern with somebody transitioning from being an agent to being in the front office, because he also might bring better insight, especially with a team that's been struggling to figure their way out for about 30, 40 years in the Wilpons organization, that he might be able to bring a completely new idea to how you need to be running this organization based off of how he negotiates with agents. So how he negotiates for players and would with agents. So I think both are it's nice to be blindsided by the fact that it's not Doug Melvin and that they're thinking slightly outside the box. You remember when you heard about how, you know, Fred Wilpon was a little wary of thinking outside the box because Mickey Callaway kind of backfired. It was just such an asinine thing, and I keep going back to Fred Wilpon's thought process. You know, he's a Brooklyn boy. Of course, I love his Brooklyn roots, but whether it be the sun is shining, whether it be skeptical that about the Yankees being able to sustain anything, even though it's happening right in front of him, I just think the game is passing him by, of all people, and I think that Jeff is right to be winning the tug of war with how, you know, the direction they need to go with the person making the majority of the front office decisions here.
Well, I congratulate both of you for changing my mind, because had one of you been hosting and I had to answer that question, I would have been ripping this whole concept of interviewing an agent. And you guys enlightened me with your opinions and insight as to how that might be a good idea. You really have me thinking a different way than when this show started, honestly. Because I didn't think it was a good idea from jump. Having heard it from you guys, well, I certainly have to consider it now. I honestly mean that. You changed my mind about that. No conflict of interest. Huh, Sam? With Brody?
Well, okay, so you were talking about, I mean, he most likely, if he's right now, what, you guys said he's DeGrom's agent?
Well, he's DeGrom's agent. He has 6 clients on the Mets. He's a co-owner or co-something of CAA Baseball. So I would think, you know.
So unlike the presidency, does he have to give up any of those conflicts of interest?
I don't know. You know, that would have to play itself out.
It's a different thing whether they were his clients, and obviously I think they probably just end up going with somebody else at CAA. The fact that he's a co-owner of CAA does bring a little bit more curiosity to the table.
Yeah, he is in fact at CAA Baseball. So there it is. So, you know, here we go. 2 candidates, pick one. I think we're all in favor of Chaim Bloom, are we not, Rich?
Well, if you think about Chaim Bloom, he went to Yale, which is kind of cool from my perspective, but isn't he the quintessential double-edged sword? Because think about it. He comes from the Rays, and what's the first thing you say? You said it yourself a few minutes ago when you think about the Rays. They're always there. They're always in contention. They do it on a shoestring budget, and isn't that cool? So if you bring in Bloom, are you saying to some degree that the frugalness will continue? And we're bringing in a guy who could win on a low budget, which is why they brought Sandy Alderson in the first place. So is that, yeah, okay, great. You know, he's able to compete on a limited budget, but does that also say we're going to have a limited budget going forward, so we need this guy? So he's heavy.
May I jump in, Rich? May I jump in?
Sure.
Please do.
I think the biggest issue has been how the money has been spent as opposed to the lack of spending. If you look at it, especially the last few years since they won the World Series, they've had $150 million budget, and it's also been the highest in the history of the Mets. So I don't care how much money is spent. I care where it's spent. You know, enough Bobby Meneas, enough Oliver Perez's. That's basically what we're looking for. We would not be talking about Madoff. We would not be talking about the way the Wilpons do business if they were winning. If they were winning year in and year out, we'd applaud them for not wasting their money and actually making it work. And so that's not my concern. It's only my concern making it work.
Yeah, there's something to that, Sam. I think the other side of that, though, is you're right. It starts with how the money has been spent. But look at Lorenzo Cain. You know, they didn't want to go and give him the years he wanted, the money he wanted. Yes, that's partially because they had spent money inappropriately in other places, or not the best investments in other places. But it also means that they're making decisions based upon that. Like, in other words, they're not willing. They still have that philosophy of, we project what our revenue is going to be, and then we spend according to that, right? That's not the way the Yankees do it. It's not the way the Dodgers do it, Red Sox do it. It's that philosophy that's still there, that, you know, that we're going to do things this way. And I wonder if bringing in Bloom, as smart as he must be, because that team does win on a shoestring budget, if bringing Bloom basically signifies that will not change going forward. I don't know. That's my only concern about him.
But to continue the debate before Mike brings it back up, though, again, you know, they've been spending the money. It's the question of where they spent the money. And Sandy Alderson, I think we forget sometimes that Sandy Alderson, I don't think, was inclined ever to give out those types of long-term deals. And it's why that, you know, I don't think the Wilpons are necessarily the reason why Yohannes Cespedes could only get a four-year contract, why he only gave a four-year contract to Curtis Granderson. I think that was very much the way Sandy Alderson liked to do things, and I don't know whether that's necessarily a symptom of the Wilpons.
You might be right about that, Sam. You just might be fucking, dead on about that. I'll go back to when they hired. Sorry,
it's
folks.
Always nice
I'll go
when
back to when
gets dropped without the Coop around.
You know what? That one totally slipped. But I'll go back to when they hired Alderson. If you remember, that was going to be Fred's call. That was going to be Fred's call. And if you remember the initial process that they underwent in search of a general manager, it was a joke until Bud Selig stepped in and offered them Sandy Alderson, and they jumped all over him with haste, which effectively ended their search, a search that I believe at the time they were incapable of conducting. And I just think, you know, that should have been Jeff's first hire, but it was a hire by default. Here we are, and now this is Jeff's first hire. And I'll go back to that tug of war against Pop. You know, just very, very interesting. This is his first move. You know, I think Sandy Alderson was one of those patchwork items handed to them by MLB. And they said, look, hire this guy. He'll run your organization. Just make sure you get your bank book, you know, in order. And they're still not being, you know, forthright with us as far as their finances. We know that. They're just not being, you know, upfront and honest with us about it. But we know better. So as far as – Rich, you know what? What you say, though, because this guy knows how to operate on a shoestring budget, you know, that might just give them license to continue, you know, in like fashion. And that's scary. But at the same time, I'll be fair, the Wilpons have spent money. They have. They've spent it, you know – 15 years ago, 10 years ago, and right up until Madoff. And, you know, they're creeping back upwards. You know, not to our satisfaction, but they're creeping upwards. They're still in a payment program that still is in existence for another 2 years, I still think. You know, so they have to predict their economy on a year-to-year basis. 2 years from now, I think, is the true test. But I'm ready to move ahead with Bloom. I'm ready. I asked you guys to have fun. And for a second, play owner and come up with a question that you would like to ask a prospective general manager. Sam, as an owner, what is your question to Rich and I as prospective general managers? Did we lose Sam again? Going once.
Sounds like.
Going twice. All right, Rich. You're the owner. I'm the GM. Interview me, man.
All right. So, Mike, thanks for coming in today, talking about the GM jobs. So here's my first question for you. You've obviously done some research on the status of the ball club before coming in here. So given where we are, we have good starting pitching. We need some help in the bullpen. You know, we have some exciting young players. Given all that, talk to me about what your direction is. Do we tear this thing down and rebuild from the bottom, or do we keep the foundation and try to add some pieces around it?
Yeah,
okay.
Is that,
Sam, you back?
That was a brain fart on my part because I still had it muted. Well, you didn't lose me.
My answer to that would be, sure, I could sit down and you know, go through reams of information, stats, video on the year that was, and make an assessment off that. Or I would respectfully ask for 1 year to evaluate this entire organization, and I will know then with certainty whether we just need a quick retooling or if we indeed need to strip this thing down to the core, grassroots effort. That
Fair
would be
enough.
My answer, Rich.
Fair enough.
So, Sam, we're at the part where I ask you guys to play owner, and we would be the prospective GMs and answer the question. So, Rich, go ahead and ask Sam, as an owner, your question for the interviewee.
So, Sam, here's my question for you. It would seem that the quickest way to bring some talent into this organization, some major league ready talent, would be to trade a starting pitcher or two. Those are our most valuable assets. So tell me, would you work from the starting pitching and trade one of our blue chippers like a DeGrom or a Syndergaard or even a Mats or a Wheeler to start to bring in that talent? Or would you seek a different way to do it? And if so, tell me what that different way is and be cognizant of the fact that we don't want to raise payroll this year.
I personally, if I were the GM, I would not be looking to trade either Jacob DeGrom, Noah Syndergaard, or Zach Wheeler right now. That is a three-headed monster that could just tear this league apart right now, especially with the way Zach Wheeler finished the year. Steven Matz is a different story. You have to think outside the box of the fact that there is an emotional connection to him being a local boy and growing up being such a fan of the Mets. But I think that you, for one, if you were to think of those, like, you'd have to get such crazy, crazy returns right now. But then you'd also be in the position of making sure that you have your eggs lined up in the minor league to make sure you can replace the type of skill set that you would lose when losing one of those guys. Noah Syndergaard also started coming around. I'm in no rush to be trading Noah Syndergaard right now. And I have to group Wheeler into that because for me, you have to see that pay off after so many years just to all of a sudden trade him, and especially because he's been vocal about not wanting to go. But that, again, I'd also be, I have to play devil's advocate with myself because I said you can't have the emotional connection that you have with Max. So I guess the only person that I would consider, I think between, you have to think about it. I think Noah Syndergaard is, at his best, a better pitcher than Zach Wheeler. And so if you were to take from anywhere, you'd have to take it from either Wheeler or Mats. But I am in no rush, after what Zach Wheeler did, to trade Zach Wheeler. And so I think you if you're not trying to raise payroll, then you have to look at where else payroll is being eaten up. And honestly, you have to consider this. Maybe you got to get Cespedes healthy, and you have to consider trading him. Obviously not this offseason, but by the trade deadline, to try to spread the potential return around. And I guess that's basically my answer. I don't know if you're talking about not being able to raise payroll and having to use the idea of not adding payroll and deducting it while trying to make your team better. The only place to look is Cespedes, but he's got no value right now. So I think that you've got a young, exciting potential team going forward. You cannot tear any of that down. Look at what's going on in the World Series right now. As good as the Dodgers are, Boston is a buzzsaw with much better pitching. And you keep seeing it with the Yankees. You keep seeing it with the Dodgers. The lack of pitching catches up to you in the World Series. And that's why you really have to think about that three-headed monster.
All right. I'm going to take my turn. Rich, welcome. I'm paying this guy $30 million a year, but my manager wants to discipline him just to prove a point. I don't pay people to sit. What do you do? as my general manager?
I empower the field manager to make that call, and I tell the field manager to do what's right for the team. I would have to respectfully push back on your position about that and say that while I recognize you don't want to pay people to sit, I also recognize that we have to sometimes take a short-term hit for a long-term gain. We have to nip bad behavior in the bud, and if the field manager feels as though a star player has not hustled or whatever it might be and wants to bench him for a game or two, I would say that I completely support the field manager in that about the long-term gain, and I would be more than happy to explain to you why I made that decision.
Rich, from your lips to Joan Payson's ears, oh, I love you. All right, Sam, welcome to my interview process. Now, I don't know you. You don't know me. We just happen to be in the baseball industry together, and we've heard of each other. What makes you so special? What makes you different? What are you going to do to turn my club into a winner?
Well, you got a good foundation of young players. You've got the pitching in line. I need to see where to best maximize performance everywhere. And you need to stay contact-oriented. I thought that you guys had a good thing going by the end of the year once you got out of the walk-walk, three-run homer. And you need to find a certain budget in line, especially with some dead weight, unfortunately, either on the injured list or in performance. You have to see where you can maximize all different angles, whether it be from the minor league system or whether it be from the free agent system. Last year you were able to get a pretty budget third baseman. I would maybe examine exactly where you can fill some of the holes and see who's on the free agent market. Maybe up what I'm willing to offer some of these guys a little bit more. But there are ways to maximize the budget while also maximizing the type of play that is involved. And you have to see who those players are out there. And if they want to come to the Mets, you have to recruit them.
All right. Take it away, Sam. Your turn. Ask the question.
Well, I am wondering, as an owner, what type of play you expect to see on the field to win in this day and age?
Is that for me or for Rich?
I thought you specified Rich, but it was breaking up. Go ahead, Rich.
Okay. What type of play I expect to see on the field? Would expect to have a culture where hustling everything out and playing the game the right way fundamentally is an expectation. So therefore, I don't care if it's the bottom of the seventh inning in a 6-1 game and it's 100 degrees out and somebody hits a ground ball to short, I expect that guy to give me 100% going down the line every time. I expect people to hit the cutoff man every time. And if we're not doing it, then someone is accountable, and we have to take action. The action I would propose would be if players are not hustling, they sit. And I don't care if they're embarrassed. And if guys aren't hitting the cutoff man, what we do is we show up at the ballpark at 4 o'clock the next day for a night game, and we do outfield drills. We do PFP if we have to. Wherever the issue is, we work on that collectively as a team to make sure we get it right. So if it's one individual, that individual can be punished singly by sitting or by reduction in playing time or whatever it might be. If it's a collective thing where we're not hitting the cutoff man the right way and we're not backing up bases, we will show up early as a team and we'll do the work like we would in spring training to make sure we get that stuff right.
All right. Mike, here's my question.
Same question?
For you.
Okay.
Here's my question for you. Jose Reyes has to stay.
I'm sorry. Jose Reyes what?
Jose Reyes has to stay. No. In all seriousness, As you said, I'm the owner of the Mets, so I'm just, you know, that's one thing I'm saying right now. But go ahead and please answer the question that I framed to Rich. What type of play are you looking for, and do you expect to see from this from a Mets ball club that will win in this day and age?
At the very least, as Rich said, attention to detail. I want a team that is masterful at small ball. At the very least, they should be able to manufacture a run the old way, and I will play up to analytics the best I can. But at the very minimum, there must be a fundamental core, a bottom-level common denominator, an expectation that everyone must meet. And if you do not meet that, the competition will be in place to correct that situation. Because my organization, from rookie level through AAA, will be operating according to one standard operating procedure. And if my third baseman gets hurt today, I can insert someone who will be of similar like mind, manner, fashion, and fit in, hopefully, seamlessly into the ongoing operation. But that has to start with my scouts who bring talent into the organization. So they, too, must be of like mind. Therefore, everyone, from yourself, the owner, on down to our most remote scout, be it in Asia, South America, Europe, wherever it may be, if I issue a standardized test to everyone within this organization, they should all answer question 1, 2, and 3 the same. So I need a fundamental understanding of what it is that we're trying to accomplish on a daily basis. And most of that entails doing your job and maximizing proficiency, efficiency, and availability. And above all else, accountability. But at the very least, you will know the fundamentals of this game and execute the bare minimum. And again, I will try to play up to analytics as best I can when called for. No more, no less. Interchangeable players. Common mission statement. From top to bottom, communication is key, and performance will prove that out. That's my answer.
All right. I like it.
That's my answer. So, gentlemen, I think we covered everything we wanted to. Let's have a little fun. A few minutes, and then we'll wrap this up. Boston Red Sox are playing the Los Angeles Dodgers in this year's World Series. Series is shifting out to Los Angeles this weekend. 102 years ago, these teams met for the only time in their team's history up until this year. 1916, the then called Brooklyn Robins face Babe Ruth's Boston Red Sox. The games in Boston were played in Braves Field, one-year-old Braves Field. It was opened in August of 1915 with vast dimensions. And, of course, in Brooklyn, the games were played at Ebbets Field. The 1916 World Series, Sam, Wilbert Robinson's Robins, American, Well, you know what? You pick it up.
I'll take it away. What's so interesting about this time is that they would not refer, you know, nicknames weren't really a thing completely yet, but people were calling their teams by the nicknames, which are now official as, you know, the it would be the Robins the Brooklyn Robins National League Baseball Club if it had held. But, you know, they were referred to as the Robins of the time because of Wilbert Robinson, who was the manager. They pulled off 94 wins this year in a 154-game schedule, which is extremely impressive. And it was their first, I believe it was their, Mike, correct me if I'm wrong, but it was their first winning season in Ebbets Field, correct? 1913 being the first year of Ebbets Field.
You are correct, my friend.
So what's interesting, obviously, I think with the Red Sox at this point had the experience, whereas the Robins, you know, much similar to the 2015 New York Mets, were the up-and-coming ball team. And unfortunately for the Robins and the Brooklyn fans, they lost this series similar to the 2015 Mets at 4-1. They did not, like, they didn't lose it as tragically as the 2015 New York Mets did, but apparently if the pattern were to continue, considering that this was, they won the only game that they won was the first game ever, first World Series game ever at Ebbets Field, just like the 2015 Mets, the only game they won was the first World Series game ever at Citi Field. I find it interesting comparison, not just because of the up-and-coming New York National League ball team element of it, but also because Citi Field is modeled in facade after Ebbets Field. So if the pattern were to hold, the Mets will make the World Series next year and lose it, as they did as the Brooklyn Robins did in 1920. But hopefully they can change that a little bit and win the last game of the year next year. But that's not what we're talking about. What's interesting about Game 1, it's similar to Game 2 of the 2000 World Series in that they had a ninth inning push to try to at least tie the game. Unfortunately, they scored 4 runs but still lost 6-5. And then they lost a heartbreaker. And this is the part that really gets me about Game 2, is that not only was Babe Ruth the winning pitcher with the game being decided in the 14th inning, but the game lasted 2 hours and 32 minutes with a bottom of the 14th walk-off win by the Boston Red Sox. Flynn was able to win by 1 run in Game 3, the first game at Ebbets Field. But unfortunately, the next 2 games were won by Boston 6-2 and the final game 4-1 on. And at this time, since it was so much earlier, October 12th was when Brooklyn's demise was seen. But there must have been a lot of optimism, Mike, at this time for the Brooklyn squad. And unfortunately, it could not hold in the coming years until 1920. But then that was the last time they saw the World Series until 1941.
Well, it was their first pennant of the new century, for sure. But the Red Sox were in mid-dynasty. No denying that. About that game two, Braves Field was brand new, and the outfield dimensions were just, you know, stupid. Straightaway center field was over 500 feet away. Jimmy Johnston leads off the game with a fly to straightaway center field that probably lands on Bedford Avenue had they played that game at Ebbets Field. It goes for a long out. Two batters later, Brooklyn hits an inside the park home run to take a one-nothing lead. Babe Ruth, as you say, he pitched 14 full innings for the victory. He only surrendered one earned run. The other was it was the only run of the game, excuse me, for the Robins. He walked 3 and struck out 4. Sherry Smith of the Dodgers pitched 13 and two-thirds innings in a hard luck loss. Hey, what are you going to do, right? Numbers I haven't heard of these days. But Babe Ruth pitches has his best season as a pitcher in his career, his brief pitching career. But the Red Sox are in mid-dynasty, man. I don't think anybody was going to stop them. They got steamrolled. Robins got steamrolled in this series. It's funny, though, because like what's going on in this World Series, the Red Sox using their starters as relievers. Wilbur Robertson was doing the same thing with Pfeffer. That was his ace of the season. He won 25 games that year, but he used him strictly in relief during the season, the series. Rich, anything about the 1916 World Series?
Well, you know, as I look at it, I you guys have covered a lot of the what happened on the field. A couple things I'm noting here is that at Braves Field, as it was called instead of Fenway Park, which is only 4 years old at the time, they drew 43,620 people for the final game, which is impressive, you know, because we've been doing this for a while on the podcast. We're talking about, you know, 1920, 1921, 1915, whatever it was, and teams were drawing, you know, 500,000 and 600,000 for the entire season. And here you have 43,000 people for the World Series, which is a bit surprising to me. Does that surprise you guys at all?
Well, it was built,
thinking the same thing, that game two had 47,000 people, and that says a lot about how I guess that a lot of more people do pay attention once the playoffs come around, but you know, there wasn't as many distractions back then, and so the entire city's focus ended up being on baseball.
Well, it's impressive.
That's precisely why they played at Braves Field, for the added capacity over Fenway. But it was built, you know, specifically to fit more people. It was only, like I said, it was opened in August of 1915. But the thing is, you say they drew 47,000. Now, when the series shifted back to Ebbets Field, Sam, did you hear that Charles Ebbets jacked up the prices at the last minute to $5 a ticket, and people were in an outrage, and that's why they only drew like 21 to 22,000 to the game?
I most certainly read that at some point in my studies. Shameless plug, Bedford and Sullivan, The Story of Brooklyn and the Dodgers. Go to Facebook.com and like it. But I it wasn't fresh in my mind. And, you know, Charlie Ebbets was a very beloved figure of Brooklyn, but not then. Not in that moment.
Well, you know, he certainly did that. He jacked up the prices, and that's why they only drew 21,000 at Ebbets Field.
So I have to say this. I can't help it. If we teleported ourselves back to that World Series and said to walk up to any random person and say, hey, you know, how much did you pay to sit here? Oh, I paid $350. And told that person, these are actual numbers off of StubHub, that if you fast forward 102 years, to buy a standing room ticket at Fenway Park, for the World Series, $545. Could you imagine what their face would have looked like? $545 is probably the price of their house. And could you? Oh my God!
It's funny you say that. You know, they were banks were giving out 5-year mortgages back then. I'm glad you brought that up. 5-year mortgages, could you imagine?
You know,
no.
I just talked to somebody who bought their house in Jersey City for like $30,000 in 1969 and just sold it for $700,000. So pretty good turnaround,
yeah.
Huh?
That's an ROI.
Yeah, that's about right. That's about right. Gentlemen, I think that's a wrap. Would you agree?
Yep.
All right, let's start off with the final word. Sam, take it away.
Clarity. I'm glad that there's starting to be a little bit more clarity, and it's coinciding with their time frame for having a GM go to the GM meetings. And it sounds like they will, depending, of course, how the series plays out, one way or the other, Anthony DiComo of MLB.com, the Mets beat reporter for them, is saying that they should have a decision by Monday, most likely, which is an off day for the World Series. Usually they don't like to announce anything for during the World Series, but you know, unless you're A-Rod, of course. But I think that there's going to be a little clarity coming forward about what the Mets' plans are for this offseason, and that's a great thing.
Rich?
Decision. I would like to see a decision made on the general manager. It certainly seems like there will be one made in time for the GM meetings, which take place the week after the World Series ends. So I want to see a decision. I want to see that's the first major domino to fall. so the team could set a direction for the offseason. I kind of thought it would be today. I know that they don't like to make this, announcements during the World Series. I get that. But Mickey was hired last year during the World Series on the off day. So something just told me something might leak out tonight about the decision being made. But I could wait till Monday. Let's just make a damn decision already, get the person in place for the GM meetings, and get the process started for the offseason.
Intrigued. I'm so intrigued. This father-son dynamic has just got me so intrigued. Without polluting this whole thing with all the other opinions we have of the Wilpons, in and of it by itself, this power struggle, I just find so intriguing. I'm dying to see how this plays out, you know, moving forward with whomever they hire. It's just interesting to me how this dynamic with Fred and Jeff is playing out. So intriguing. Gentlemen, it's been my pleasure and my honor hosting you gentlemen this evening. Thank you. And how we end this usually goes something like this. Let's go Mets, right?
Let's go Mets. Let's
go Mets.
Mets.
Good night, everyone.
Mets.
Good night. Thanks for hosting, Mike.